As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. If you listened to some of Britain's shoutier politicians, you'd think the place was being overrun with unskilled, needy migrants. Ignore them. The truth is, the country has almost accidentally become really good at creating prosperous, well-integrated immigrants. And all the talk around electrification of road transport seems to focus on passenger cars. But the vans and lorries end of the market is a huge source of emissions, and electrifying it is going a lot slower than the world needs it to. First up, though. Just after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, Western leaders thought they could put serious pressure on President Vladimir Putin.
Putin chose this war, and now he and his country will bear the consequences.
The consequences were supposed to come after severe restrictions aimed to damage Russia's economy.
Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions and new limitations on what can be exported to Russia.
We have acted with the US, the EU, Japan, and Canada to cut Russia's central bank off from our markets.
At first, the ruble plunged as these trade and financial sanctions took hold. And as Russia shifted to a war footing, the spike in spending on soldiers' salaries and weaponry sparked eye-watering inflation. But none of the economic indicators was flashing red for long. If anything, the picture just keeps getting rosier.
Russia's economy has repeatedly defied the doomsayers.
Callum Williams is a senior economics writer for The Economist.
In early 2022, there was no financial collapse, contrary to predictions. There was a recession, which was sparked by Western restrictions, but it ended quickly. And now, even the rate of inflation, which recently has been Vladimir Putin's biggest worry, seems to be falling.
So you would say then that Russia's economy is in rude health at the moment?
I think rude health is probably going a bit too far. I think it's worth remembering, though, exactly what people were predicting would happen when Russia invaded Ukraine. There were predictions for really an economic collapse. And for a few days following the invasion, it looked as though that is what was going to happen. But since then, the economy really has bounced back fairly quickly and now appears to be in a situation where, relative to pre-invasion forecasts, GDP is in line or even a little bit higher today. Inflation moved up and down over the past 2 years, but hasn't actually caused as many problems as some people had predicted and now seems to be heading downwards.
So in thinking about the inflation that has worried perhaps Vladimir Putin as much as everyone else around the world in their own local economies, what's the explanation there? How is it that they are keeping the numbers down?
It depends on who you ask. The finance ministry wants to take credit because last year their officials successfully lobbied for exchange rate controls. Now, basically, these compel exporters to deposit foreign currency in the Russian financial system. And this has the effect of supporting the ruble, which makes buying imports cheaper, so it helps to keep inflation down. On the other hand, you have the central bank, and they believe that their policy of more than doubling interest rates since July of last year should instead take the credit for the decline in inflation. Now, they say that higher interest rates have encouraged Russians to put money in savings accounts, which is true, rather than spending it. And it's also helped to dampen down credit creation. In fact, few other central banks have been as tough as the Russian central bank in recent months.
I love this framing where we got the central bank and the finance ministry like slagging each other off on Facebook or whatever.
It's kind of like that.
In what way? How does that manifest?
The central bank and the finance ministry are at loggerheads verbally in statements, in press conferences, in reports that they are both publishing in a way that you might not expect from a policy that's as closed and authoritarian as Russia. But I think what it illustrates is something very interesting about Russia, which is that, yes, of course, it's a kleptocratic, authoritarian state. But when it comes to economic policymaking, it's strikingly orthodox. And the people in both the finance ministry, but particularly the central bank, are often highly trained, often Western trained economists who actually really do know what they're doing. And there is a sort of surprisingly open debate in Russia about who's making the best economic policy, who's right, who's wrong. And it's actually all there for the world to see.
And what's your take on who's right? Who's responsible for this resilience?
So I think on balance, probably the central bank. I think it's probably correct to say that the finance ministry's capital controls have helped to support the value of the ruble a bit. But I think what's really made a difference is the fact that Russian rates have gone up so substantially that it has helped to attract some capital from abroad and has also meant there are big incentives now to put your money as a Russian into a Russian bank because you do get a pretty juicy interest rate on your savings. Controlling inflation is all well and good, but that achievement would be a little bit soiled if it had the consequence of destroying the economy. Now, what's been so interesting about Russia is that even as inflation has come down, economic activity has held up pretty well. So it's on track for a soft landing, just as much of the rest of the world appears to be too.
But how does that work? How does Russia get a soft landing out of this, even though there are these severe policies from the central bank, from the finance ministry?
We think it's largely a consequence of past stimulus that's been handed out to both households and to businesses over the past few years. So both corporations and households have built up pretty large cash balances. And what this means is that they can continue spending even in the face of high inflation and high interest rates. And companies can also avoid defaulting. I think the other thing to remember is that despite the inflation, people do remain employed at high levels, and this helps to support consumption. I think businesses are very reluctant to fire workers at the moment because there has been such an acute labor shortage in recent months, both because people have fled the country and also because large numbers of people have been called up to fight against Ukraine. And so bosses are kind of reluctant to let people go unless they absolutely must. And then something else that's going on that is unique to Russia is to do with businesses and factories and offices that were formerly owned by Western investors. So they obviously closed in large numbers in 2022 and 2023. More recently, they have reopened under new, often Russian management. And so that's also helped to give the economy a bit of a boost.
Everything that we've talked about so far is sort of the internal dynamics of the Russian economy. But what about how it fits into the global economy? That was supposed to be pinched off.
Totally. So sanctions are in place from the West, but what's basically happened is that Russia has reorientated its trade to other countries. So this matters for two reasons. One is to do with what it sells to the rest of the world. So it's now selling a lot of oil to places like India and China, and that's helped to kind of compensate for the lost Western customers. The other thing is that Russia has developed new import links. So it's now importing a huge share of its imports from China. And that's helped, again, to make sure that they can keep the economic show on the road.
So is it too simplistic to suggest then that the sanctions regimes enacted so far have done kind of nothing that they were intended to do?
I think that probably would be broadly fair. They have definitely resulted in a short-term hit to the Russian economy. That now appears to be over. I think it remains to be seen how big the long-term effect will be on Russia on being excluded from Western trade and investment networks. But I think what is very clear is that the notion that the sanctions are going to force Putin and the Russian government to the negotiating table vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine has shown not to have succeeded.
And aside from that, in this sort of medium term that we're living in, what are your predictions for the Russian economy? More growth, more stability, more strength?
The Russian economy has not been strong in a comparative sense for a long time. It's doing fine. Most middle-income and rich countries across the world are doing fine, and Russia is one of those. It's not booming, but it's also not collapsing. But I think the fact that it isn't collapsing goes completely against what almost everybody expected 2 years ago.
Callum, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Jason.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Just as it is elsewhere, immigration has long been a touchy subject in Britain, especially on the political right. Successive conservative governments have presented eye-catching border policies, often focused on reducing the number of asylum seekers and illegal entrants.
Today, the government has introduced the toughest anti-illegal immigration law ever. I know that it will upset some people, and you will hear a lot of criticism about it.
Despite the tough talk, though, the number of foreign-born residents has been increasing. Census data show that 10 million people in England and Wales, a sixth of the population, were born outside Britain. That's a higher share than in America. To hear the right tell it, it's a catastrophe. But the facts on the ground suggest a very different story.
Britain has a very fraught politics of immigration. It's something that many people are very angry about.
Joel Budd is our social affairs editor.
Conservative MPs, particularly the ones trying to become the leader in the party, are frequently very, very anti-immigration. And there's a sense that immigration is out of control, not working very well. But the truth is that Britain is extremely good at handling immigration.
Well, what do you mean by that, though? What do you mean about it being good at it?
Britain isn't particularly good at immigration in a kind of bureaucratic sense. We're not very good at running an immigration system. It's a very slow system. It's extremely expensive.
Confirmed.
But what Britain is incredibly good at is turning foreign-born people from a wide variety of countries into productive, well-educated, culturally integrated people.
So let's dig into that a little bit, those levels of integration, social, cultural, economic. Give me some numbers.
So it's the case in Britain that foreign-born people earn, on average, basically the same as British-born people. It's also the case that the employment rates are almost identical. That is not the case in many, many countries, especially in many European countries. You see rates of employment for foreign-born people being a good 10 percentage point below natives, and wages are frequently lower as well. So Britain is getting something right when it comes to getting foreign-born people up to speed economically.
What about in other terms, though?
So the children of immigrants do pretty well in British schools. They didn't always do well. If you go back and look at reports on migrants' children in the 1980s, they described an absolute calamity. These days, that's not the case at all. In fact, at GCSE, which is the main exam that children in Britain take when they're 16... children who don't speak English as their first language actually do better than children who do speak English as their first language. And again, this is really, really unusual. The OECD runs tests called PISA tests every few years. And those tests tend to show enormous gaps between native-born children and immigrants' children. In Britain, those gaps are just negligible. Or in some cases, immigrants' children are doing better.
So if things seem broadly well among the foreign-born, then why is it so fraught in politics to talk about the foreign-born in immigration?
There's a quite unusual type of immigration, which is incredibly high-profile and really, really disliked. And that is people floating across the English Channel in small boats from France and claiming asylum. This is not a huge number of people. Last year, it was 30,000 people in the context of total immigration being more than a million. But it's such a vivid demonstration of a country that has sort of lost control over its borders that it gets people very upset. And I think the second reason is that there are some examples of places where immigrants and their children and their grandchildren haven't integrated all that well. And there's a sort of obsessive focus on those places. Just recently, there was a big focus on Rochdale. It's a town just north of Manchester. It's poor, used to be a cotton mill town, and it has a Pakistani population. And they've been, over the years, somewhat troubled. They were brought in to work in the mills. soon after they arrived, the mills all closed. So they were stuck in a part of England that was not doing well economically and still isn't doing well economically. And they've struggled with integration. So all that is troubling, but the truth is it's quite rare. I think that if you want to see the present reality of immigration in Britain, and certainly the future, you should not be looking at somewhere like Rochdale. You should be looking at somewhere like Reading.
Why? What's going on in Reading?
Reading is a quite ordinary, reasonably successful town to the west of London. It's, to be frank, not the most thrilling place in the whole of Britain. It works well. It's got a hospital. It's got a university. It's got a bunch of IT firms. And the immigrant population there is growing really quickly. So Reading is now about one-third foreign-born. Immigrants have been coming to Reading for a long time. They started arriving in the 1950s. They were often Indians or people from Barbados. And they started to settle in quite a dispersed way. So when immigrants moved to cities like London and Birmingham and Leicester, they frequently ended up in what were basically ghettos. And the reason they were in ghettos was really that there was quite a bit of violence directed against them. And so they had to cluster because it was too unsafe to be anywhere else. In Reading, that just wasn't the case. There was prejudice in Reading, but there was never really extreme directed violence. And so immigrants started to scatter all over the city. And that has remained the case ever since. And that is increasingly the pattern now all over Britain.
What changed about Britain in a more general sense?
Well, a couple of things changed in Britain. One is that Britain simply evolved much firmer anti-racist and anti-discrimination norms. It's hard to remember now, and perhaps it's embarrassing to remember for people like me who were in Britain in the 1970s and 1980s, how very, very, very violent white people could be when they sensed that they were being encroached upon. And that simply went away, not obviously completely, but people became able to disperse. And then the second thing that happened in Britain, which is much, much less fortunate, is that housing has become so extraordinarily expensive over the decades that you just have to go wherever you can afford.
You're describing a situation where the nation, on the whole, has gotten kind of more chill about immigration. But we started off by talking about how not chill, in particular, the Conservative Party is. Why is it that they're picking at that if, more broadly, people are just less concerned about immigration than they once were?
Yes, the average British person has become more relaxed about immigration, but the politics of immigration have become extraordinarily fractious. The truth is that there's a kind of imbalance in how much immigration motivates voters. So people who are pretty relaxed about immigration don't really vote on the issue of immigration. They will vote on things like the economy or healthcare. But people who are really anti-immigration, who feel like it's a huge problem for Britain, really will base their vote on immigration. And this is true in other countries as well. And so if you're a sort of anti-immigration politician, it actually makes great sense to bang on about immigration a great deal because you can pull anti-immigrant voters towards you. And then another reason is that people who are really relaxed about immigration tend to live in big cities, and they tend to live in heavily labor areas. People who are more anti-immigration tend to be older. They are much more likely to live in marginal constituencies, so they're just really valuable. So parties are being wise when they're pursuing those people's votes very hard.
So as the country gets more relaxed in a general sense with immigration, do you think the politics around this will change, or will that imbalance that you describe only become more stark?
I think one possible future for Britain, I think actually quite a likely future, is that people will continue to become more familiar with immigrants because of the spreading out. Those who remember a far more homogeneous country will obviously become fewer in number. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to calm down about immigration politically. There are always ways to have rows about the numbers, exactly what kind of immigrants are coming in, what kind of immigrants should be coming in. And that's fine in a way. It's kind of normal politics.
Joel, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We're constantly dipping into the story of the changeover from this to this. It's a bit stop-start in many markets, but the electrification of personal vehicles is amping up. In Europe, 1 in 7 new cars purchased is electric. In China, that's 1 in 3. But when it comes to commercial vehicles, those numbers change a lot. Of the lorries, trucks sold last year in Europe, only 1 in 70 was electric. Even in China, where a huge majority of e-lorries were sold last year, that number was only 1 in 25. This part of the market is frequently overlooked in all the talk of future vehicles, but it really shouldn't be.
Well, in the long road to decarbonising economies in general, decarbonising road transport is an important part of that.
Simon Wright is The Economist's industry editor.
We've seen that passenger cars are electrifying at a rate that is much quicker than lorries. And lorries are a big part of the carbon emissions. For example, on EU roads, it's estimated that lorries and buses are responsible for over a quarter of all the carbon emissions.
Well, then why isn't the electrification of vans, trucks, lorries happening at that same rate as it's happening for passenger cars?
Well, look, there are several reasons. Decarbonising much bigger pieces of road transport is more difficult. But I would point out that for vans, which are much more like cars and last mile delivery, decarbonisation is actually coming much quicker. Big lorries, it's much more difficult. How do you get those big lorries to move? Well, batteries is one answer, but batteries for a large lorry that need to be big and bulky. And that comes with a set of problems, first of all. That bulk of the batteries could take up precious cargo space. Secondly, you need to recharge those batteries. And thirdly, those batteries are expensive, which makes the vehicles far more expensive. And with commercial vehicles, the really important thing is not the badge on the front. For a commercial vehicle, the decision is made in a finance office with somebody tapping on a calculator to work out the total cost of ownership. That is the cost of buying and running the vehicle. And that's what's really, really important. And at the moment, that total cost of ownership, certainly for big lorries, is higher for those ones that run on electric.
Okay, so that's the buyers. What about the sellers? What's changing there or could change faster?
Look, all the big lorry companies are working on electrifying their products. But, you know, for them, it's just like the incumbent car companies. It's quite difficult for them in the sense that they make their money from the internal combustion engine. The boss of one Swedish startup making electric lorries said that going electric for the big incumbent lorry makers would mean writing off 7 or 8 years of profit because of the big investments they'd need in order to go electric.
So the slope of the curve clearly isn't great, but the direction of travel, as it were, is pretty clear. I mean, how do you see this situation changing in the near term anyway?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. I think it's the same with passenger vehicles. As the technology improves, prices will come down. I mean, in the next few years, electrification is likeliest for smaller vehicles, as I talked about vans earlier, operating over shorter routes such as last mile delivery services. Purely because the economics of those is already there for total cost of ownership. Plus, if you're going over a relatively short distance and you're based in a central depot, you can sort of charge there overnight. That's not really a problem. Electric vans could have even a 10% cost advantage over conventional ones in some instances already. And the other reason that we might electrify soon is that companies have net zero targets, and in order to meet those net zero targets, getting their supply chains or even their delivery companies to go electric will help them meet that. FedEx, for example, has set a target for half its parcel delivery vehicles to be electric by 2025. And Amazon has 10,000 electric vans on American roads and hopes to have 100,000 electric vans by 2030.
And you mentioned along the way that the regulations are different for trucks and lorries. I mean, surely that would speed the transition along too.
That's absolutely right. They're really not as tough as they are for passenger cars, but that's not to say there aren't regulations in place, and that's not to say they aren't getting a little bit tougher. In America, there are proposals that will require half the sales of new buses and a quarter of new heavy-duty lorries to be all electric by 2032. Also, there's sort of tax credits available for buyers of clean vehicles. The European Union is requiring cuts of 15% to the average emission of fleets by 2025 from their level in 2019 and 43% by 2030. So the regulations are pushing in the right direction. Look, I think a combination of improving technology and tightening regulations means that the electrification of lorries is coming. It's coming more slowly than for passenger cars, but the destination is clear. And one day in the future, I think we'll find that all road transport is electric.
Thanks very much for your time, Simon.
Thank you, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, let us know what you think of the show. Drop us a line at podcasts@economist.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.